Have you ever asked yourself why? Well, now you can ask Andy why. News, views and conspiracy theories.
Ah, this is Andy Why on the Beetroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley with the Andy Why Show. Dr. Andy Yates here. Got a brilliant show for you tonight, which is the best of British banking. How can there be anything good about that? Well, we're taking a bit of a sideways look at it. I've picked some things out of history which are interesting. And what I'm kind of thinking is, as we go through the show, it's just keep a kind of a thought about, because we went through the crisis in 2008, didn't we? And that was awful. And it brought the whole economy down across the world. And I'm not saying it was exactly Britain's fault, but it was, in association with the United States, really. Between those two, we screwed it all up for the world. And it's like, well, obviously nobody knew this was going to happen. But I don't believe that for a second. Because what you'll see is that this kind of thing has happened over and over and over again throughout history. And we don't learn from it. And when's the next one going to be? Because we're going through some troubled times at the moment, all about making money. And do we stay as a capitalist society or socialist or somewhere in between, which would be my choice. But there we are. That's the way that is. And I have to mention, this will be my last show for a little while. I've got to turn my research and analysis head into working on my second book. But hopefully that won't be permanent. We will see. But that's what it is. But don't forget, if you want to look at any of my shows, they're squeezed down to podcasts with the music removed on www.drandyyates.com. And usually I'll make a comment on that. About less than 20 minutes long. So if you're driving somewhere, go and do your shopping, something like that, you just want to pop something on of interest, of get away from the usual stuff, unless, of course, you're listening to Beetroot Radio, then that's okay. And, yeah, it's all out there on the YouTube channel, the Incongruous channel. I've had some interesting results on that. It seems that if I do a show on cannabis, that's quite popular, but everything else is just, yeah, kind of ticks over, so it's doing all right. But anyway, there you go. So, okay, let us talk about the best of British banking. And what we've got to understand is that the banking industry, the centres of banking, certainly in Britain, would be the City of London. And really, it's a question of, well, how did that come about? Because we know from history that Londinium was established by the Roman legions about the date of AD 43, so 43 after the year zero, right? And it was quite a city. The thing about things in those days, if there was a decent river around, if you built a bridge over that river, well, this was going to concentrate the population around that bridge, because you couldn't, you know, the Thames is quite a big river. It wouldn't be good to swim that every day. So if you got a bridge, then people are going to use the bridge. You can charge a toll on the bridge, I suppose. But you can also, as I said, then you set up some shops and some stalls and stuff like this, and it grows from there. So what the Romans did was they built a bridge over the River Thames and turned the city into a road nexus and, of course, also a major port, because you've then got the Thames estuary going out and to Europe, which, of course, was, you know, populated and becoming more and more, shall we say, civilized at that time. And so London had the opportunity and did serve as a major commercial center in Roman Britain. And but of course, it was abandoned, and I mean abandoned, in the 5th century, because the people that were left here, what should we say, we were the Celts before the Romans came, and then we sort of went through, I don't know, after the Romans went, we were British for a while, because Britannia was what the Romans gave to our country, our kingdom, if you like. But then in came the Saxons. Saxons came from France, right? The Angles, they came from Germany. We became Anglo-Saxon when that got together. All the time through this, we've got Vikings coming in and out and stealing stuff and, you know, raping and pillaging and all that good stuff that Vikings do. And then, of course, around 1066, in came the Normans. So we have that progression. But London was kind of left after the 5th century. And it wasn't until Alfred the Great came along, and he was the king of Wessex. Now, if you look at the names of the counties that are in England, you can get some idea of that history, because you've got Wessex, Sussex, Essex. It's all got that sex on the end. And what that sex refers to is Saxon. All right? So think about that. Wessex, Essex, Sussex. And then above that, you've got the region of East Anglia. And Anglia would be the Angles, which were the Germans. I think they came from South Germany, who also came in. And there was a battle between that. And then right in the middle, over towards the middle and Wales, was a place called Mercia, which between those three and actually Northumbria, up above that, those were the four major centres that built over time. But when Alfred the Great came along, he decided to resettle the old Roman walled area, because walls were good in those days. And in 1886, and he appointed his son, the Earl Ethelred of Mercia, over London as part of their reconquest of the Viking-occupied parts of England. Now, so we then had a refortified, later on, Anglo-Saxon settlement, because Alfred was an Anglo-Saxon. It was known as London Burgh, which translates to London Fort, which is a borough. So London Burgh, a borough. And the historian Asser said that Alfred, king of the Anglo-Saxons, restored the city of London splendidly and made it habitable once more. So Alfred's restoration enabled reoccupying and refurbishing the nearly deserted Roman walled city, building quays along the Thames and laying a new street plan. And that street plan that Alfred put down has pretty much stayed there. Even though a lot of London, as you know, was destroyed by the Great Fire and stuff like this, they had all these plans to redesign the city, but it sprang up again on the old street plan. So really, we've got a street plan going back thousands of years. Now, Alfred's taking of London from the Vikings and the rebuilding of the old Roman city was actually a turning point in history. Because not only was it the permanent establishment of the city of London, but it was also part of a unifying moment in early England, the Kingdom of England. Because remember, at that time, England was a kingdom, Wales was a kingdom, Scotland was a kingdom, Ireland was a kingdom. They were all separate kingdoms. In other words, they had a king in charge of them, and he had a domain that would be a kingdom, wouldn't it? So, so it unified it. And basically, Wessex became the dominant English kingdom and helped with repelling the Viking occupation and the raids and stuff like that. So while London and, in fact, England were afterwards subjected to further periods of Viking and Danish raids and occupation, the establishment of the city in London and the Kingdom of England prevailed. And it just kind of continued because it was so strong. You get that. Okay, so in the 10th century, an ancestor of Alfred was Æthelstan, and he permitted 8 mints, so that's mints that are making coins, right, to be established, compared with the 6 in his capital, which was Winchester, which is also Wessex. So you can get that feeling that Winchester was the old Saxon capital, but as they sort of combined with the Angles and became more Anglo-Saxon, there was that tendency to move over to the city of London. And they built London Bridge, right, was in ruin following the Roman evacuation, the abandonment of Londinium, but it was rebuilt by the Saxons, even though it was periodically destroyed by Viking raids and storms and stuff like this. They just kept rebuilding it because it was such an important place, especially with all the quaysides along the Thames there. And as trade and population moved back to within the old Roman walls, the older Saxon settlement of Londonwick, which was kind of nearby, was largely abandoned and gained the name of Eoldwick, which means the old settlement. And that name survives today as Oldwich, which means the old marketplace. And that is, in fact, a name of a street and an area of the city of Westminster, between Westminster and the city of London. Okay. So, as I said, you've got the Angles, the Saxons, then the Angles, they became Anglo-Saxon, kind of joined with Mercia. And then they were doing basically what the aristocracy has done over thousands of years. They were marrying each other to join different kingdoms. And there was just this whole cycle of wanting more land, getting more land, being invaded, pushing back the invaders, raising money to get armies, to on and on and on and on. That was just life. That's the way it was then. And of course, the peasants had to grow food and farm cattle, stuff like this to feed all of this. But basically, it was be conquered, then conquer, then be conquered, then conquer. And so it would go on through millennia. But along came the Normans. And of course, following the Battle of Hastings, William the Conqueror marched on London. And he reached as far as Southwark. But he failed to get across the London Bridge or to defeat the Londoners, because they were pretty nicely walled in their little place there. He eventually crossed the river at Wallingford and then pillaged the land as he went. Now, it was pretty obvious that William was going to win. So rather than continuing the war, Edgar, who was the Aetheling at the time, Edwin of Mercia and Morcar of Northumbria, they all surrendered at Berkhamsted. So William granted the citizens of London a charter in 1075. So from 1066, 1075. So just 9 years later, he said, all right, we'll make a special case of the city of London. The city of London, we will allow to retain some authority. And we will also not cover it in the Domesday Book. And this is what's happened with the city of London. It has always kind of remained apart, both the city of Westminster and the city of London. Okay, so you get that. All right, so going back to some history, let's move on a bit and we'll move on to the 1100s. And this is when the Knights Templar came along. And they were throughout Europe, right? Don't think this was only in Jerusalem and France and places like that. They were in England, Scotland as well. And they ran the earliest European-wide Mideast banking sort of company until the 14th century. In 1127 AD, just to show that, land was granted for the first temple church in Holborn, London, which is inside the city of London. It's the place called Temple, right? You'll see it now. There's a tube station, everything. In fact, the church is still there. And Temple, I think, is the place where all the lawyers are, where they have their bar. Oh, not all of them, but certainly it's a major centre for the lawyers. Temple Bar. Right, you get it. Okay, so all that history still remains. But they started banking. Now, they found this new way in 1150, around then, of guarding the pilgrims, because basically they were there to guard the pilgrims as they travelled to Jerusalem, the Holy Land, right? But rather than guarding the pilgrims, they came up with this idea of guarding their valuables. So before a pilgrim would leave, they would say, hey, there's 100 pieces of gold. And the Templars would give them a letter of credit, which was obviously you could cash that in at any Templar stronghold. And it would be worth 100 pieces of gold less a small fee. Now, the problem was, of course, is that there was the usury, which is charging interest on a loan, was a sin at that time. But to get around that, they didn't charge interest. They called it rent. So they rented the money for a while. Whatever. There's always a way around, doesn't it? It doesn't matter how religious you are when there's money involved. But anyway, so the Templar wealth grew very, very quickly. They owned large tracts of land in Europe and the Middle East. They built castles, bought farms and vineyards, were involved in manufacturing, import, export. They had their own fleet of ships and for a time owned the whole island of Cyprus. And if you want to know more about the Templars, check back on www.drandyyates.com because I did a whole show on it, 90-minute show. Alrighty. So in 1190 AD, Richard I, that was the Lionheart, he led the Third Crusade and recovered much of Christian territory. But it was a problem because you're talking about people coming from a long way away fighting the locals. And 1191, the city of Acre, the best port in the coast, was retaken of the Muslims. And was the new capital of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, because they'd already lost Jerusalem to the Muslims. I'm not sure if that was Saladin at that time, but anyway, it was the Muslim armies. Richard had to leave about a year or two later in 1192 to defend his crown against his king brother John, who had called himself King John, who was considered historically to be the worst king England had ever had, by the way. And he was buddies, John was buddies with King Philip of France. So he went back. So in 1263, another point of interest, is Prince Edward, who became Edward I, actually ended up ransacking the Templars' temple treasury in London. And because some theorists say he was looking for treasure of a different kind, like the Holy Grail or Covenant, where the Ten Commandments were stored, right? Or the nails from the cross or the Spear of Destiny or whatever that was, right? All of that stuff. The Ark of the Covenant was what I was trying to think of. So, but anyway, he raided it because that's how things had changed, because the Templars were going out of fashion. Because the Templars were warriors. No matter what you look at it, no matter how much they had all these religious ideas and kept themselves celibate and stuff like this, they were brutal, brutal warriors. Weren't much good at anything else. Weren't good at running cities or towns or anything like this. That's all they did, and lent money. So after a while, kind of people got fed up with them. So I think that's why that happened. And this was what we're seeing now is the decline of the Templars. In 1871, Edward led a crusade and was attacked by an assassin with a poisoned knife. He was saved by medicine from the master of the Templars. So there was still some good stuff going around and things like this. And of course, now Edward now owed the Templars a debt of life. But hey, if when you're a king, you can do what you want, can't you? I like that. Sorry. Sorry, that was a call coming in. I might cut that out, might just leave it in. Shows it's a live show, doesn't it? Yes, it does. King Philip of France asked for a Templar loan. Now, King Philip of France was deeply in debt to the Templars. He already was. And the Templars made a bit of a mistake and they refused. Instead of coming to some middly thing or saying, we'll give you half the money now or something like this, they said, nah, we ain't doing it. We ain't doing it. And of course, the Templars got to know that the original knights originally came from France. So there was a great deal of Templar influence in France. No doubt they owed lands and castles and stuff like this. And the king would have been very jealous of their wealth. And but at the same time, I guess the Templars had some wind of this, because what they actually did was a load of ships left Rochelle, France, and legend has it they headed for Scotland, and that then is the whole Grail thing. But listen to my show on that and you'll get all that. I don't want to talk about that here. And on Friday the 13th, and that's why the day became an unlucky day, Jacques de Molay, the master, and 60 knights were arrested in Paris and tortured. The interesting thing is, when they were caught, they were just there. They didn't run away or anything, because this was a pious, godlike thing. And if if they'd been sent to be tortured and executed, well, that was God's way. That's part of God's plan. But they didn't have any treasure. None at all. No gold, no riches, no anything like this. Just the people. And there was this odd idea that they were tortured and confessed to heresy. But then the Vatican came along because the Pope was trying to save them. And so the Vatican's inquisitors came along and questioned them, and then they rescinded their confession. And then when the Vatican's inquisitors went away, they were tortured again, and they went back to saying, yes, they committed heresy because the torture was obviously so dreadful. And in the end, the king said, well, I want to kill them. So he killed them. And they were burnt at the stake, some of them. So there we are. But that had started this idea of being able to loan money, being able to give people notes for money, and this idea of holding credit and then earning interest or rent, as they called it, on the money that you'd loan. So this basically was the start of a banking system, because the Templars would hold the money, the original 100 pieces of gold, we said, they would hold that safely until the pilgrims returned, and then cashed in what was left of their bond or whatever that was. They'd get some of their money back, less a fee. Okay. But as again, remember what I said, this is all about history, and looking at history, can we see a plan, a plot, a pattern that seems to keep recurring over time? So we'll jump forward in time to 1542. And this is where we had the great debasement. Because remember, the kings and the aristocracy were running everything still at this point. The great debasement was when the English crown's policy of coin debasement during the reigns of Henry VIII and Edward VI. So we all know Henry VIII, so we know he was around in the 16th century, I think. The Great Debasement was from 1544 to 1551, which saw a currency debasement policy introduced in 1544, in England by Henry VIII, which saw the amount of precious metals in gold and silver coins reduced. Because in the old days, the coins had their own inherent value. If you had a gold coin, it was worth something because it was made of gold. If you had a silver coin, it was worth something because it was made of silver. That may have been the same for some of the lower ones, like a penny being made of copper. That may well have been true as well. They actually had their own inherent value. Well, what Henry did was he said, nah, we're going to change that. And he reduced, in some cases, and replaced entirely with cheaper base metals, the gold and the silver in coins. So now these coins effectively became symbols of a certain amount of money, rather than actually being worth a certain amount of money, if you get that. And the problem was, of course, Henry VIII liked to have a good time, and his overspending and his lavish lifestyle, and also the fact that, as usual, he wanted to fund wars, mainly foreign wars, with France and Scotland, and these were the reasons that were cited for the policy's introduction. And the main aim of the policy was to increase revenue for the crown at the cost of the taxpayers. Always that. Revenue for the crown at the cost of the taxpayers through savings in currency production with less bullion, that's raw precious metals, right? Bullion being required to mint new coins. Following debasement, gold standards were dropped from the previous standards of 23 carat, so that's the purity of the gold, to as low as 20 carat. While silver was reduced from 92.5% sterling to just 25%. So that stuff was kind of junk. It was revoked in 1551 by Edward VI, and the policy's economic efforts and effects continued for many years until 1560, when all debased currency was removed from circulation. So you get the idea of the monarch being totally in charge of the flow of money, and will even manipulate the money system so that they can get their money for their lifestyle and to fight war.
Andy Way on Beatroot Radio.
And that's Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And don't forget, I'm doing my last show for a short time. It's a sabbatical more than anything else, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, so we've just been talking about the Great Debasement, how the Crown could change the coins pretty much whenever they wanted. But, of course, things have changed in the 17th century, the 1600s, because there was a Commonwealth formed when Oliver Cromwell took over for a while, and they executed Charles I. And then they brought Charles II back, which was the kind of, there's a word for it, I can't think what it was now, but it was when they re-established the monarchy. And then, of course, then there was the Great Revolution, which occurred when they got rid of Charles II and brought in William and Mary. And all that part was to do with Catholics versus Protestants, because I think it was Charles II. He was a converted Catholic, but his children were Protestants, and one of his children was Mary. And so what they ended up doing, the British people, or the English people, I should say, was they went to William the Third of Orange from Scandinavia, whatever, right? And said, hey, because, again, they're all related, you see, because the European monarchy very much related to the English and British monarchy as a whole, because that's they have to keep the royal line, the bloodline, right? So that's where that came from. And then William and Mary, so William ended up being king and queen. They ruled jointly. I think Mary died first, then William died, and then another break came along and they changed. But these were all part of that same follow on. You get what was happening, right? Okay. So 1694, what happened then? So this was just the time after the Great Rebellion. The Bank of England was founded because we had the king back, and now the king needed to get money again. Because England had suffered a crushing defeat by France, and they were the dominant naval power, France. And in naval engagements, and it culminated in the 1690s Battle of Beachy Head, and that became the catalyst for England to rebuild itself as a global power. England had no choice but to build a powerful navy. Unfortunately, there was no money available. And the credit of William III's government was so low in London that it was impossible for it to borrow the 1,200,000 pounds, and that would have been at 8% per annum interest, that the government wanted. And you'd think, well, where would they, if they'd got the money, where would they get this from? Well, they would invent it out of the air. And this is what banks do. We'll come on to more of that as we go on. But they would just say, well, there's another 1,200,000 and we'll print the notes or the coins right now. Now, while those coins were related to something solid like gold, well, then you had to have gold. So that kind of kept things a bit more sensible. But anyway, that's the idea, to give the king, King William III, credit. So what they wanted to do was increase subscription to the loan. So subscribers to the loan, that is people who invested in that loan, were to be incorporated by the name of the governor and company of the Bank of England. Now, the bank was given exclusive possession of the government's balances and was the only limited liability corporation allowed to issue banknotes. And that's what I'm talking about, that creation of money out of thin air. There's nothing there. They just say, oh, well, there's a note that's worth £1,200,000. Go and spend it. And it's come from the government, so it's valid, so you can use it to spend. So in a sense, now the government owes 1,200,000. The king owns the government 1,200,000, but also the king has got 1,200,000 to spend. So you've actually created 2,400,000. This is how it works, unfortunately. Anyway, the lenders, would give the government cash or bullion and issue notes against the government bonds, and then they could lend them again. So not only had you got this debt against the Bank of England, then they would issue notes to their lenders. Their lenders could use those notes to buy things. So if you had £1,000 invested in the bank, you could grab that note for £1,000 and use it to buy whatever it is for £1,000. I don't know, what would that be, a ship or something? So you could buy that ship for £1,000. So now you've just created another £1,000 out of that original money that came from nowhere. You see where the problem starts to occur? And this is right back at the, you know, almost at the beginning of the 18th century, 1695, when they formed the bank. So, okay. Of course, there was a good side of it, because the side effect was that there was a huge industrial effort needed to rebuild the navy. They had to establish ironworks and make advances in agriculture so they could feed the quadrupled navy strength, and then that started to transform the economy. And this helped the new kingdom of Great Britain, because around just soon after that, when they started the Bank of England, Scotland and England became formally united in 1707. This is where the first James, the first Stuart of the line of kings of Stuart, actually came over, and he became James the First of England, James the Sixth of Scotland. So he united the two and brought them both together, because he was the only one in the bloodline that was available. Got it. Okay, so that made the navy in Britain soon become dominant. And in the late 18th and early 19th century, it was the most powerful navy in the world, which is how we made money for the empire. So, okay, what also happened in 1695 was the Parliament of Scotland created the Bank of Scotland. Now, this is before they joined with England. So the governor and the company of the Bank of Scotland was established by the Parliament of Scotland on 17th June 1695. And it was the act for erecting a bank in Scotland and opening for business in 1696. It was established soon after the Bank of England, which was established 1694. But the Bank of Scotland was a very different institution. The Bank of England was established specifically to finance defence spending by the English government. The Bank of Scotland was established to support Scottish businesses and was prohibited from lending the government without parliamentary approval. Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? The Founding Act granted the bank a monopoly on public banking in Scotland for 21 years and permitted the bank's directors to raise a nominal capital of £1,200,000 Scottish pounds, which was actually only £100,000 sterling. But it gave the proprietors, the shareholders, limited liability. In other words, if the bank crashed, they would only owe so much. They couldn't take all their money off them. They would only so much, a limited liability. So in the final clause, which was only repealed in 1920, it made all foreign-born proprietors naturalised Scotsmen. Isn't that interesting? Up to 1920. And they were made naturalised Scotsmen, quote, to all intents and purposes whatsoever. So they were Scotsmen. because they were proprietors of the Bank of Scotland, even though they were foreign-born. Now, the Bank of Scotland was suspected of Jacobite sympathies. Here's the problem. And this is this back to this Catholic-Protestant thing, because James, remember I mentioned James the First, James the Sixth of, James the First of England, James the Sixth of Scotland, same guy, right? Just had those two titles. He was a Catholic. That was part of the problem. And, of course, since Henry VIII, the English and then the English and Scottish crown was Protestant. Because Henry did that so he could get divorced, right? So the Jacobite risings, known as the Jacobite rebellions or the War of the British Succession, were a series of uprisings, rebellions and wars in Great Britain and Ireland, occurring between 1688 and 1746. Now, the uprisings had the aim of returning James II of England and 7th of Scotland, who was the last Catholic British monarch, and then his descendants to the throne of Great Britain after they had been deposed by Parliament during the Glorious Revolution, which is when William and Mary came along. King William, Queen Mary, who joined, right? Because they were brought over because they were Protestant. So there was a series of conflicts, and it takes its name from Jacobitism, from Jacobus, which is the Latin form of James. So it's all about King James the First and King James the Second. Now, going back to the Bank of Scotland, its first rival, the Royal Bank of Scotland, was formed by Royal Charter in 1727. So this would be a Protestant bank. The bank traces its origins to the Society of the Subscribed Equivalent Debt, which was set up by investors in the failed Company of Scotland to protect the compensation they received as part of the arrangements of the 1707 Acts of Union. That was when England and Scotland came together as one kingdom. The equivalent society became the equivalent company in 1724, and the new company wished to move into banking. So that's how they set up the Royal Bank of Scotland. The British government received the request favourably, as the old bank, the Bank of Scotland, was suspected of having these Catholic Jacobite sympathies. And you can't have that. All right. What that did was lead to a great competition between the two banks, obviously the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland. And they did all kinds of nasty things to each other to try and drive each other out of business. Now, the bank wars ended around 1751. But of course, competition soon arose from other sources, such as other Scottish banks and that were founded throughout the country. So in response, the Bank of Scotland itself began opening branches throughout Scotland. And they actually opened a branch in London in 1865. So you can see how that spread. And of course, London was the centre of economy and becoming the centre of economy for Europe and then the world. Let's talk about the gold standard. Because we talked about Henry VIII reducing the quantity of precious metal in the coins. But you want some kind of standard by which you can sell things to other countries. And that standard must have a worth. And that's easy when it's tied to gold, because gold is worth whatever it is worth at that time. And you say 100 pieces of gold, the value of that gold is going to vary, but it's still 100 pieces of gold, the price. Now, the British West Indies was one of the first regions to adopt what they call a gold specie standard. And a gold specie standard was a coin, basically a coin that was already in existence. Now, following Queen Anne's proclamation of 1704, and I think Queen Anne was the successor to William and Mary, the British West Indies gold standard was a de facto gold standard based on the Spanish gold doubloon. Okay, so a gold, Spanish gold doubloon was a standard coin of a certain amount of gold in there and a certain weight and size. Spanish gold doubloon, that was the gold standard. Now, 1717, Master of the Royal Mint, Sir Isaac Newton, that's right, that Isaac Newton, the physicist, right? He did all kinds of things, it seems. He established a new mint ratio between silver and gold, and what that did, that actually drove silver out of circulation and put Britain on a gold standard. And a formal specie standard, that's the one where it's the gold, coins, right, was first established in 1821, when Britain adopted it following the introduction of the gold sovereign by the new Royal Mint at Tower Hill in 1860. So now the sovereign, the gold sovereign, which is a coin made entirely of gold, was now the standard. The new standard ended the circulation of gold specie coins, like the Spanish doubloon. But instead, the law compelled authorities to sell gold bullion on demand at a fixed price, but only in the form of bars containing approximately 400 ounces troy of fine gold. So if you didn't use the gold sovereign, then you could sell a bar of gold. But the bar of gold had to be 400 troy ounces of fine gold. Now, this really got kind of nasty, because the gold standard in 1925 was repealed, and it was changed to gold bullion. So instead of having coins anymore, you just had bars of gold. And you've all seen pictures of the bars of gold. Watch the movie Goldfinger and you'll see lots of them, right? So that replaced the gold coin standard in 1925. So now there was only gold bullion that could be called. And that's the bars, the 400 ounces, troy ounces, 12 kilograms of fine gold. Now, there was a famous economist, British, very influential, regarded as probably the best economist in history. It was a guy called John Maynard Keynes, and he came up with Keynesian economy. But he said it was a bad thing to resume a gold standard. And he talked about deflationary dangers, which meant because the gold tended to be at a fixed price, if there was deflation, in other words, the value of money went down, that made the value of gold go up, which could lose money because now you would have more trouble selling it. It would be worth more. When you, for example, if a bar of gold, say, was worth 100 quid, let's choose some numbers, right? 100 quid. And then there was devaluation of the current currency, it could end up that that bar of gold was actually worth more because the pound is worth less. So if you returned a bar of gold, you could make more money out of it. So there was that problem, and that's what's called deflationary. Okay. But they fixed the price of pre-war gold at $4.86 in 1925. Churchill. Now, Churchill is argued to have made an error that led to the Depression, the unemployment, and the 1926 general strike. That decision that Churchill made was described by Andrew Turnbull, who was a baron, as a historic mistake. And Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister, in 1931, said, had to come back to the government and say, gentlemen, quote now, His Majesty's government have given the most serious consideration to your letter of the 19th instant, in which you inform them of the grave difficulties with which you are faced in meeting the obligation placed on the Bank of England by the Gold Standard Act. His Majesty's government are of the opinion that the Bank of England should place such restrictions on the supply of gold as the bank may deem requisite in the national interest. So the gold standard was thus swiftly abandoned after about 6 years, leading to a sharp devaluation in sterling, and that helped the UK recover from the crisis in 1931, because basically then there would be, was because it's devalued, the money is devalued, so that would mean there's more money available. What that would do is give central banks more flexibility to promote growth or devalue currencies to deal with debts. But of course nowadays, one of the things we do to do that is quantitative easing, and people may regret the days when we used to have a gold standard, because quantitative easing is basically printing a whole bunch more money. And that devalues the money, which means there's more available, which means it looks as if we're doing better because we got more money, but we haven't got more stuff. So suddenly your £100 in your pocket nowadays will only buy 90 quid's worth of stuff as was a year ago, if that makes any sense. Right? So you might say your £100 in your pocket now, next year, will only buy 9. And this?
Andy Way on Beatroot Radio.
Community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And don't forget, this show and all my past shows, because this show is going to be the last one for a little while, are all available on www.drandyyates.com. So if you've got an hour to spare, you might want to go out there, cruise out there, listen to a show. And if any of your friends ask about it, you can refer them to www.drandyyates.com. They can go check that out. Also, of course, there is my YouTube channel, which is the Incongruous channel. Look it up. You'll see I have a number, probably 20-odd videos out there now, which are just a kind of an interesting take on certain things. Some of them are kind of funny. Some of them are a little bit more poignant. All right, so we're talking about banking. Not sure that that's terribly funny, but isn't it interesting the way things cycle around? Now, this one's even more interesting. And this is the 1825 panic, in which 70 UK banks fell. 70. Now, the panic of 1925 was a stock market crash that started in the Bank of England, arising in part out of speculative investments in Latin America, which included an imaginary country, and I'm going to pronounce it Poyais, P-O-Y-A-I-S, Poyais. It's quite an incredible story. You would not believe it to be true, or maybe you would. Anyway, this guy, he called himself a general, Gregor MacGregor. And he lived from the 24th of December 1786 to the 4th of December 1845. He was a Scottish soldier for sure. He was an adventurer for sure. And he was a confidence trickster. Incredible confidence trickster, who attempted from 1821 to 1837 to draw British and French investors and settlers to Poyais, a fictional, and I say again, fictional Central American territory that he claimed to rule as cazique. So you're talking about a place, British Honduras. Well, it used to be British Honduras. Now it's Honduras. So it was a British territory, but it was jungle. That's all it was. So there are a few sort of tribal leaders around at the time that the British gave the title of kings to. And then this guy, Gregor MacGregor, came along and said that one of those kings had given him grants to certain land and then lied about the land as if there was a town there with a church and a town hall and stuff. Complete lied. It was untouched jungle. The sad thing about it was, because hundreds invested their savings in supposed Poyasian government bonds and land certificates. Actually, in actual fact, about 250 actually emigrated to MacGregor's invented country in 1822-23 and found all there was untouched jungle. When they contacted the local king, who was the one who was supposed to have granted them the land, he said, no, I haven't granted the land, and if I have, I ungrant it right now. So they were left pretty much on their own. They became sick. They didn't know how to take care of themselves. Half of them died. Some of them were rescued by sort of British ships coming down from Belize, which is the next country up from Honduras. And five or six more ships actually left harbour heading for Poyais, but the British Navy turned them around and said, go back, this is all a hoax. Because the survivors, some of the survivors from those first, there were two ships, I think, actually got back to England and said, this is all a scam. But the guy kept doing it. Then he went to France and he was doing it over there and selling these different things like this. He went to jail and then was released with no charge and stuff like this. And the other thing he had is he had fought in some battles in Venezuela, in the Central American government, for the rebels that were out there. And he'd acquitted himself well in one battle, but in several other battles, he'd abandoned his troops, he'd legged it, he'd, was there to defend the harbour and the coastal town, and halfway through the battle, he'd jump on a ship and run away. I mean, this was a guy. But somehow, he was such a good talker or something, and he created detailed maps and plans and documents and stuff like this. Quite extraordinary when you go and look at it. It's quite fun going through all that stuff. But anyway, he, and in the end, even though his scheme was one of the most brazen confidence tricks in history, even though he sent many immigrants to their eventual death and abandoned his troops in battle, did all these things, he died peacefully in Venezuela in the end and was given full military honours. Because the rebels, who then became the government, gave him the made-up title of Lieutenant General or something like this. And, of course, with a title like that comes a military pension. And so he went to Venezuela, insisted he got his title back, and a military pension, and settled down there, having left all this carnage behind him of people who'd lost all their money, put all their family savings into what was a fiction. What was a made-up stuff, the biggest scam, perhaps, in history. Quite amazing. It was kind of in the size of Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff took more money, but it was even more widespread than that, because he tried it in various different countries, and it worked. People were... Because at that time, people were... what would I say that was? 1865, something like that? At that time, this is as we were heading towards the Industrial Revolution. Yeah, 1825, Panic of 1825, and things were getting good. And this is why the banking issues started. So anyway, forget about Poyais and Gregor MacGregor now. Let's talk back about that 1925 banking crash. So the crisis was felt most acutely in Britain, where it precipitated the closing of six London banks and 60 country banks in England. So not the big guys, but the little ones. It was also manifest in the markets of Europe, Latin America, and the United States. And it was only through an infusion of gold reserves from the Bank of France that saved the Bank of England from complete collapse. So that would have been a loan back to the Bank of England. So everybody's loaning money everywhere. And it's fine if you got gold. The problem is when you create the money out of nowhere. But we'll go on to that a bit. So the panic of 1825 has been referred to as the first modern economic crisis, which is not attributable to an external event such as a war. And thus it was the start of modern economic cycles. And that suggests that these things do happen in cycles. That also suggests, does it not, that really we should know when these things are going to happen. We should understand. We should be able to do something about it in advance, proactively, rather than waiting for things to get to a stage where everything crashes on down, and then try and recover from it. Unless, of course, it's kind of fixed, so that even if there is a crash, some people still get wealthy from that crash. So we're talking 1825, which is the period of the Napoleonic Wars, and those were exceptionally profitable for all sectors of the British financial system. And the expansionist monetary actions taken during transition from wartime to peacetime economy initiated a surge of prosperity and speculative ventures. The problem is the stock market boom became a bubble, and bubbles burst. The banks got caught up in the euphoria. They made risky loans because it seemed like they could, because the interest rates were low and there seemed to be plenty of money around. And then it all crashed down. And the banks had loaned money to make the loans so they could make profit on the loans that they'd sold, and they couldn't pay to service the original loans. So it goes on. We've seen this happen before quite recently. So there were other things that happened in the market. In 1986, so we're coming up a lot more modern now, there was a thing called the Big Bang. And this was deregulation of London financial markets. And this may have been one of the steps that allowed the London Financial Services and other financial services in Britain to be able to ride roughshod over the government, the will of the people, the good of the country, and just do whatever they want. Because the Big Bang was deregulation of the London financial markets, which, of course, served as a catalyst to reaffirm London's position as a global centre of world banking, because other people wanted to come in from outside, because now they had a deregulated financial market in which they could work all their stuff to make themselves a profit, right? And this Big Bang was the result of an agreement in 1983 by the Thatcher government. You remember Maggie Thatcher, or you've heard of her anyway, between her government and the London Stock Exchange to settle a wide-ranging antitrust case that had been initiated during the previous government by the Office of Fair Trading. So Office of Fair Trading had raised a case, an antitrust case, against the London Stock Exchange. So in other words, they said they've done something wrong. And this was to settle that, and the way they settled it was they removed some of the rules. So they were no longer in a problem. In other words, saying, oh, yeah, you guys are fine. You know, the Office of Fair Trading says you've got something wrong. Well, they're saying it's wrong because it contravenes a particular law. What we're going to do is remove that law, and now you're okay. On you go. Make some more money. And don't forget me at Christmas time. Right? That's the way things happen. Now, you see, the Restrictive Trade Practices Act 1956 controlled certain things about the London Stock Exchange. Some of the rules about fixing fixed minimum commissions, which meant you couldn't pretty much bribe people. The single capacity law rule, which enforced a separation between brokers acting as agents for their clients on commission and jobbers who made their markets and theoretically provided liquidity by holding lines of stocks and shares on their books. The requirement that both brokers and jobbers should be independent and not part of any wider financial group. The stock exchanges, we'll come on to that. So basically what you're saying is the people who are buying and selling stock should not really be the same people who are actually making those stocks available to the market. And that makes sense, really, because otherwise what you're likely to happen is the people who make those things available to the market might start twisting things around. You know what I'm saying? They might start bending things so that the market changes because of the stocks that they're bringing on, rather than just concentrating on, well, we've got mock stocks that people want to sell. They'll only bring on the ones that suit their buddies. You get the idea. Well, then that's what happened. They took away those rules. They also took away a rule which excluded foreigners from stock exchange membership. And there's still some of that around. And you're not allowed to exchange. I know at the moment there's some rules because of the United States and their sort of, oh, you might say, money-grabbing ways, that they believe in double taxation. So if you could be taxed by both the United States and the UK, for example, if you had access to both types of stock markets, instead of just paying the tax in one country and having an agreement on that, no, you've got to pay the United States as well. And you see, that's part of the problem. Okay. So the day the London Stock Exchange rules changed, which was on 27th of October 1986, it was dubbed the Big Bang because of the increase in market activity expected from an aggregation of measures designed to alter the structure of the financial market, make things easier. The effect of the Big Bang led to significant changes to the structure of the financial markets in London. The changes saw many of the old firms being taken over by large banks, both foreign and domestic, which would lead in the following years to further changes to the regulatory environment that would eventually lead to the creation of the Financial Services Authority, the FSA, who would try to control all of this. Because now you've got these huge banks and corporations coming out who are running these things, and these is global banks and corporations. I mean, I'm trying to think what they said. Some statistic like in the square mile of the City of London, there is represented, well, buildings of 560 foreign banks. That's because their regulations, their tax rules and stuff like this are so beneficial that it makes that a place to make a financial hub. Or at least it did. Because that might all change if we leave the EU. Yeah, well, we'll see, won't we? Now, you may think that the next thing I'm going to talk about is 2008. Well, I'm not. Because there are so many other things that should have got us really ready for 2008. They should have seen it coming. And I tend to think that they did see it coming. I think they knew it was going to happen. They allowed it to happen and made certain risky ideas, like the big banks are too big to fail, because they knew they wouldn't fail because the government would have to top them back up again. And I think because how can you have this issue happening back in McGregor's time? And this one I'm going to talk about now, Black Wednesday. But let's do that, perhaps. So Black Wednesday occurred in the United Kingdom on the 16th of September 1992, when the British government was forced to withdraw the pound sterling from the European exchange rate mechanism. Okay. After a failed attempt to keep the pound above the lower currency exchange limit mandated by the ERM. So obviously, if you joined the European exchange rate mechanism, that was a thing that facilitated the exchanges of money between francs and pounds and liras and marks and stuff like this. It was the facilitation of all that change between different kinds of currency. But part of the rules were, when you remember this thing, you had to keep the value of your currency between certain limits. Because obviously if it fell below certain limits, wasn't worth much, well then that wouldn't support the whole process of having this kind of equality of different currencies. Another problem that happened at the time is it just so happened the UK was the president of the European Communities. It was really bad. It was really a mess. Now, in 1997, the UK Treasury estimated the cost of Black Wednesday at £3.14 billion. And this is back in 1997. So you could probably multiply that by 10 nowadays. But anyway, and it was revised to £3.3 billion in 2005, following documents released under the Freedom of Information Act. And earlier estimates placed the losses as a much higher range of 13 to 27 billion. And that does sound much more in the range of what would have actually happened. Now, trading losses in August and September made up a minority of the losses, estimated at 800 million. And that gives us a clue in a way, because it's not really all about trading. We think about, you know, the things we manufacture and the things we can sell around the world. But I think that's probably only about, including the agriculture, the fisheries, everything, it's only about 20% of our gross domestic product. What's the rest? Services. And at least half of that is financial services. And this is what we see. Trading losses in August, September made up the minority of the losses, estimated at 800 million. But the majority of the loss to the central bank arose from non-realized profits of a potential devaluation. In other words, if they'd have devalued the currency, they could have made a huge amount of profits. They couldn't do that because the ERM had a problem with them. They had to pull the pound sterling out. They couldn't devalue the pound anymore. So you, in a sense, you'd be devaluing the pound, or at least, sorry, using pounds to buy, I don't know, francs, say, French francs, right? And then you would devalue the pound, so there are now more pounds, so that meant your pounds would buy more francs. Of course, then eventually everything went to the euro, which the British never actually subscribed to. So then they had a common currency, which they had to keep balanced. But that was at a different time. So we're getting a warning, aren't we? We're getting a warning, because this time Treasury papers suggested that if the government had maintained 24 billion foreign currency reserves and the pound had fallen by the same amount, the UK could have actually made 2.4 billion profit on pound sterling's devaluation. But the fact was they lost over 3 billion. So in effect, they lost more like 5 or 6 billion because they didn't get the profit and they got losses. Now, in the months leading up to Black Wednesday, good old George Soros had been building a huge short position in pound sterling that would become immensely profitable if the pound fell below the lower band of the ERM, the European mechanism there, right? So what does that mean, a short position? And it's something you have to bend your head a bit to get to understand what's going on. But basically it's this. If you've got a kind of reputable upfront financial organisation, which George Soros did, right? You could go to a central bank and borrow some shares, their own shares, right? So for example, you could go to the Bank of England and you could say, hey, I want you to loan me 1,000 shares. And let's say, though, just to keep it easy, let's say those shares are worth a quid each. So £1,000 worth of shares, right? 1,000 shares. Please, can you loan me those? And I'll give you back at some point in the future. And they say, okay, that's 1,000 quid. So he pays 1,000 quid. Then he takes those shares and then sells them off to someone else at market price for 1,000 quid-ish, right? Probably less a fee or two, but other than that. So he hasn't lost any money, but he does now have this debt of 1,000 shares to the Bank of England. Got it? So he's got to pay that back. He hasn't lost any money. In fact, he's invested $1,000, right? So if the value of those shares, the Bank of England shares, falls to, say, 80 pence a share, so that whole investment is now only worth 800 quid, he can then buy those 1,000 shares from somewhere else at 800, for 800 quid, and then give them back to the Bank of England. So with 1,000 invested, he's now paid 800 for that 1,000 invested, so he's made a profit of 200 quid. That's what a shorting is, I believe. So you understand. And this is what George Soros did against, you know, and he's, I don't know what country he's from, America, Israel, somewhere. That's what he did against the Bank of England. And they said he was the man who broke the Bank of England. He didn't, but he made a shed full of money out of it. So, and because he recognised, somehow they didn't recognise, but George Soros recognised the unfavourable position at which the United Kingdom joined the ERM, believing that the rate at which the UK was bought into the exchange rate mechanism was too high. Their inflation was also much too high, triple the German rate. And British interest rates were hurting their asset prices. And Soros made over £1 billion by short selling sterling. It's just extraordinary. And that's the way it works. And it's especially bad when you have central banks. So what is a central bank? Well, a central bank, a reserve bank, or a monetary authority is an institution that manages the currency, money supply, and interest rates of a state or formal monetary union and oversees their commercial banking system. So in contrast to a commercial bank, right, which might be a high street bank or a private investor bank, a central bank possesses a monopoly on increasing the monetary base in the state. In other words, printing more money. So it generally controls the printing, coining, or whatever it is, of the national currency, which serves as the state's legal tender. So what you would have in your wallet. A central bank also acts as a lender of last resort to the banking sector during times of financial crisis. So eventually, when other things go broke, you go back to the central bank to get money out to float everything else. Central banks in most developed nations are institutionally independent from political interference. Now, the history of the Bank of England, I haven't got dates and stuff, but basically it used to be a private bank. A bit like the Federal Reserve in the United States, right? It's a private bank. Sounds like it's part of the government, doesn't it? Federal Reserve, Bank of England. No, private bank. All right. But it was nationalised, I think, by the Labour government, maybe Tony Blair or someone like that. Nationalised. But now it's still nationalised in a sense, but it's been allowed to make its own decisions. So there's a very high oversight by the government, but in actual fact, it's been allowed to make its own decisions in that way, which they felt was better for it to function without any interference from politicians. And then they could say, well, it's not reflecting political issues and stuff like this. I guess that's true. But of course, it is working in the direction of full-blooded capitalism, and of course full-blooded capitalism supports certain political aims and views and directions. All right. So, as I said, independent from political interference, and that's how that works. So a bank, like a high street bank, wants to create a load of mortgages for people's houses. So it will go to the central bank and borrow some money and then loan that money out to the people who come looking for mortgages. You get it. And then the profit they make, they will pay the interest rates and eventually pay the loan back to the central bank over time. All right. So let's talk about Northern Rock. Because Northern Rock was one of the big problems with the banking, with the crisis of the 2008, I'm going to call it. So in 2006, the bank had moved into subprime lending via a deal with Lehman Brothers. Now, what is subprime lending? Okay. Subprime is the practice of lending to persons with low credit ratings. In other words, subprime credit ratings. There have been times in the past, and there may even be times right now, where you cannot get a mortgage unless you have a certain credit rating. But then they came up with this idea, well, wait a minute. We can still make a ton of money if we loan to people who have less than that credit rating, as long as they, the people who owe the money, pay extra. Well, how can we get them to pay extra? Well, obviously we can put additional fees on there and stuff like this. What we can also do is give them an ARM, an adjustable rate mortgage. So they've got to pay extra fees and extra costs and everything like this, which they may not be able to afford if their credit rating's not good. In all likelihood, they've on a fairly low income. But we can make it affordable for them by giving them an adjustable rate mortgage. So the adjustment, the rate of their mortgage when they take it out, is a lot less than it will become later on. And don't forget, with most adjustable rate mortgages, if you came in with a mortgage, and let's be silly about it, and let's say for 5 years you pay zero interest, okay? But after that 5 years, you have to pay whatever the current interest rate is, as established by the Bank of England, the central bank. Let's make it easy and say 3%, right? But you also have to pay what money we would have made from the interest over the 5 years that you didn't pay. And we're going to add that on to the cost of your mortgage. So you may have had a mortgage on a house worth £100,000. We're now going to stick another £10,000 on because that's what you would have paid. So you have to pay for an extra loan of £10,000 over the next 25 years. Scary proposition, isn't it? Some people get away with it because basically they want that adjustable rate mortgage to keep them going for a short time. Then they're going to move to a bigger house and change their mortgage, and then they'll settle that money that they owned as part of the buying into another house. But if you don't do that, suddenly you're paying additional fees because you're a subprime lender, and you're paying the money that you owe them because you had a lower rate of mortgage from an adjustable rate mortgage. It's a nightmare. Now, we may think just of the borrower here, but then you've also got to think of the bank that lent that money in the first place. They ain't going to get their money back. Anyway, that's a subprime lender, a subprime mortgage, right? And an adjustable rate mortgage. Now, so Northern Rock had a subprime, moved into subprime lending, and they had a deal with Lehman Brothers. Now, although the mortgages were sold under Northern Rock's brand through intermediaries, the risk was being underwritten by Lehman Brothers. Well, how good were Lehman Brothers? Well, Lehman was one of the first Wall Street firms to move into the business of mortgage origination in 1997. Lehman bought Colorado-based lender Aurora Loan Services. Now, in 2000, to expand their mortgage origination pipeline, Lehman purchased West Coast subprime mortgage lender BNC Mortgage LLC. Now, Lehman quickly became a force in the subprime market. By 2003, Lehman made $18.2 billion in loans and ranked third in lending in the world, the United States anyway. By 2004, this number topped $40 billion. And of course, they're making interest on those loans. So you can imagine the amount of money that's coming in. But of course, this money is loaned. It's not real money. This is money that is loaned. This is not profit. This is not coins in the bank. This is money that's loaned. It's electronic money. By 2006, Aurora and BNC were lending almost $50 billion per month. Oh my goodness, that's a lot of money going out at an incredible rate. And remember, Lehman is carrying the risk. By 2008, Lehman had assets of $680 billion. Now, what's an asset? Well, an asset is a potential for money. It's not real money. So they may have had $680 billion worth of loans that they'd made. So in effect, they were owed $680 billion. However, would they ever get that back? Okay. The problem was, this $680 billion was supported by only 22.5 billion of firm capital. So if something went wrong, and that 680, suddenly they had to put some money into it, they'd only got 22.5 billion to actually deal with the problem. And what was said was that from an equity position, its risky commercial real estate holdings were 30 times greater than the capital. And bankers at the time said that in such a highly leveraged structure, a 3 to 5% decline in real estate, so the cost of housing, would wipe out all that capital. And then they would have no capital on which to operate. They would only have interest on subprime loans. And these are the people that were underwriting Northern Rock. Now, under the chairman of Matt Ridley, Northern Rock had a business plan which involved borrowing heavily in the UK and international money markets like Lehman Brothers, extending mortgages to customers based on this funding, and then reselling the mortgages on international capital markets, a process known as securitization. So you can see this. You borrow money from Lehman Brothers, which is electronic money, it's not real money. You then lend that money, which is not real money, to somebody who wants to buy a house just by changing the numbers on their bank statement. There's no actual money there. Now you've got a loan of, say, £100,000 to Fred. You then take that loan and say, hey, anybody want to buy this loan? And somebody will say, well, I'll take it off you for £80,000. So they pay $80,000, they get $80,000 up front. They still know that extra $20,000, but they think they'll get that back in just over time. Now they've got some cash to work with. The person who's bought it's happy because they have an expectation of getting $100,000 back, and they only paid $80,000 for it. That's assuming the loan gets repaid. And then there's interest as well, of course. Problem was, in August 2007, the global demand from investors for securitized mortgages, these mortgages that were being sold on by Northern Rock in this example, it was just falling away, it was dying. So there was no way they could offset those mortgages. And that meant that Northern Rock became unable to repay the money it had loaned in the first place so that it could loan money to the people who wanted a mortgage. Now, this problem had been somewhat anticipated by the financial markets, and that, of course, drew greater attention to it. On the 14th of December 2007, the bank sought and received a liquidity support facility, in other words, another loan, from the Bank of England to replace funds it was unable to raise from the money market. But of course that sends a message, doesn't it? And now you've sent a message out saying Northern Bank ain't worth crap. Well, people have got money in Northern Bank, right? So then what happens is a bank run. And that would have been the UK's the first in 150 years because depositors feared that their savings might not be available should Northern Rock go into receivership. The result was a bank run. And depositors lined up outside the bank to withdraw all their savings as quickly as possible. Well, we know that they don't have much cash. It's all electronic money, which is loaned out or in loans from other people. There's not much actual cash that's basing it. The only people with any cash is the central bank. And everybody's now doing it because once some depositors go in and say, hey, I want to withdraw all my savings, then other people come along and they talk down the pub and they sort of, and then now you've got these lines going around the block of people lining up and saying, yes, sir, I want to take all my savings out in cash so that they can go and take it elsewhere. All right. On February the 22nd, 2008, the bank was taken into state ownership as a result of two unsuccessful bids to take over the bank. Neither being able to fully commit to repayment of taxpayers' money within 3 years. Former shareholders and hedge funds also took legal action in January 2009 to get compensation for their shares. The shareholders lost the case. They also lost their appeals to the British courts, but then hoped to take the case to the European courts. And of course, you do know when we leave the EU, that's an option that we'll no longer have. However, on 8th of December 2009, it was announced that the valuer, Andrew Caldwell, had decided that the Northern Rock shareholders should get no compensation. So their shares were just down the tubes. But both the hedge funds that invested in it and the shareholders that invested in it are still fighting for compensation.
Have you ever asked yourself why? Well, now you can ask Andy why. News, views and conspiracy theories.
And of course, that's on Beetroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. Oh my goodness. Well, okay. It's going to be my last show for a while. Perhaps that's a good thing. I can have a rest and study me DJ's manual or whatever. Anyway, let's get moving. Finish it off. So, what were the contributors to this happening? We're talking about the crash of 2008. Well, here's the thing. Look at these numbers. Bank lending rate was at 3.5% in 2003. It was actually 1% in the USA. So that was a great time for lending money, for borrowing. The rate was so low. It was fantastic. Remember, we're not talking about the interest rate. We're not talking about the rate from the Bank of America. Because in this country, there's always a great deal of difference. In the United States, those numbers, the lending rate and the rate from the bank, the Federal Reserve, is very close. In this country, they take an extra piece because you've got a loan. Not very nice to you, this country, to be honest, but there we are compared to a place like the United States. But anyway, 3.5%. So people like getting loans. The loans are cheap. Let's get a house. Let's get it now. Of course, the problem is that went up to 5.75 by about 2007. Well, if you had a fixed rate mortgage at 3.5%, your quid's in. But a lot of people had an adjustable rate mortgage. So they started off paying 3.5% or less, right? And then they ended up paying 5.75 or more. Which suddenly, because they had that money available, they were able to get the four-bedroom house instead of the three-bedroom, or the three-bedroom instead of the two, or the detached instead of the semi-detached, whatever, right? You get the idea. So you would have stretched just to get that extra bit, because we're going to live in this house for the next 10, 15 years. We want to get the biggest house we can, the best house we can. So we'll just push it. We'll suffer for a couple of years, but we'll be fine. and then the rate changes, and then the adjustable rate steps in, and you're in a big trouble. House prices, of course, started off, your average house price, let's say, was around 100,000 in 2003. It was around 200,000 in 2007. 100% increase. That's crazy. I mean, you might say, great, I bought my house, now I can sell it and I'll make a profit, which would be true. But there ain't many buyers coming in the market anymore in 2007 because, well, houses are so expensive. So the whole thing slows down, the whole market slows down. If you've got to move and get a different house or something like this, you're messed up. Now, the average salary, how much did that increase? Well, it was about 18,000 in 2003. It was about 21,580 in 2007, which is a 1.7% increase. Hang on a minute. The bank lending rate's gone up 2.25. You've seen houses go up perhaps at a maximum 100%, say 50% to be on the safe side. But I'm only getting 1.57% more. What's the rate of inflation? Well, the rate of inflation average between 2003 and 2007 was 2%, which is slightly above any increase in salary you got. So you're actually worse off now because of the rate of inflation. You see how that goes? Not surprisingly, people got into a lot of trouble. Well, how'd you deal with it? Well, you have to bail them out. Northern Rock was toast. Nothing they could do about it. It was done. Nothing they could do. Crash and burn, I'm sorry. A bank rescue total was thought about, and they came up with this idea of some £500 billion, that's half a trillion, which is approximately $850 billion. And that was announced by the British government on the 8th of October 2008 as a response to the ongoing global financial crisis. After two unsteady weeks at the end of September, the first week of October had seen major falls in the stock market and severe worries about the stability of British banks. Yeah, seriously. The plan aimed to restore market confidence and help stabilise the British banking system, and provided for a range of what was claimed to be short-term loans from the taxpayer and guarantees of interbank lending, including up to £50 billion of taxpayer investment in the banks themselves. So money would actually go in and buy stocks, shares off the banks. Got it? Now, in some of these loans and investments via shareholdings, some of them have been sold back now. And as you'll pick up in a minute, we didn't lend to many people. But certainly two of them were the Royal Bank of Scotland, yeah, and Lloyds. Now, the money that was sold back, certainly for the Royal Bank of Scotland, has made huge losses to the taxpayer. But has provided some subsidy to the shareholders. So basically what they've done is put taxpayers' money into there, then sold those loans, which is what they are, they're taxpayer loans, they're loans from the taxpayer. They've then sold those loans to shareholders, right? Or sold the loans onto another market. And that's come back with subsidies for the shareholders, not the taxpayer. So the taxpayers lost money on this and the shareholders have gained. Wait a minute. You see what I mean when I said earlier on in the show about could somebody have profited from this? And here you see it. This didn't hurt those people at all. They got subsidies. The bank wasn't allowed to fail. So those shares in Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds, have now started to be sold off. And Labour has criticised the Conservative government for making such a huge loss for taxpayers on the sale of Royal Bank of Scotland shares. And the government claimed that this will be more than made up for by the huge profit they're going to make when they sell the Lloyd shares. But that's kicking the can down the road, isn't it? They may not even be in government then. And basically they said, well, look, if we were waiting any longer with the Royal Bank of Scotland shares, that wouldn't necessarily mean to a higher price for them. Which sounds like a whole scam to me. Now, the loss to the taxpayer of the first round of Royal Bank of Scotland's sale share-off is stated by the BBC to be just over £1 billion. Lost. Wait a minute. And that was compared to when they were sold, right? Other estimates were that the loss to the taxpayers and a consequent subsidy to private shareholders in the bank was £2 billion. This is just crazy. Absolutely crazy. Subsequently, broadly similar messages were introduced by the United States and the European Union in response to the financial crisis. Some commentators noted that, although under the capitalist model, inefficient private commercial enterprises should be allowed to go bust, but banks were too big to fail. Sometimes that wasn't the case here. And here's the big thing. Not a single bank chief or chairman, CEO, whatever, went to prison in the UK or in the US. They destroyed people's lives, lost the money in Northern Rock's case. Their shareholders lost their money. All because of irresponsible selling, subprime mortgages and stuff like that. But no one was punished for it. No one. It just was swept under the carpet. There's no oversight, no responsibility. Just, oh well, never mind. Let's get the money off the taxpayer. Which means we pay more, of course, you do understand that. Somewhere else, somewhere down the line, that money's been taken from, whether it's investment in the NHS or the police or whatever, all the stuff they're talking about now. So the plan was to open, open to all incorporated banks, all building societies, but only Lloyd's and the Royal Bank of Scotland, they were the only major recipients. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer said in 2018 that the country was hours away from a breakdown in law and order if the Royal Bank of Scotland had not been bailed out and people could not access money. So we got the people's money just in a slightly different way. This is the Andy Wise Show on Beatroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nelly Valley. We've had that show for a while. And we've been talking about banking in the UK. So how did some of these banks manage? That's the question. Like Barclays, how did they manage, right? Well, this is what we got to understand about the way things are these days. We think of English banks, Scottish banks, Irish banks, whatever, Welsh banks. British banks, they're not. Not anymore. They're multinational corporations. Listen to this. How did Barclays manage? Well, in July 2008, Barclays attempted to raise $4.5 billion through a traditional rights issue to shore up its weakened Tier 1 capital ratio. What does that mean? They were hit by the 2008 crash, right? They had a choice of getting a loan off the taxpayer, the government bailout. They were trying not to do that. This scheme they came up with involved a right to buy. What's a right to buy? It means you buy shares at a particular investment rate and then you can sell them at a fixed rate back again, which means you can get more than what you paid for, basically. Leave it there. This is the offer to shareholders and the sale of a stake to Sumitomo Mitsui Banking Corporation. Japanese, I guess. Now, only 19% of shareholders took up their rights, leaving investors China Development Bank and Qatar Investment Authority with increased holdings in the bank. Wait a minute, you're saying the Chinese own a chunk of Barclays Bank? Yes, sir, they do. And Qatar. and the Japanese, the Sumitomo Mitsui Banking Corporation. So Barclays launched a further round of capital raising approved by special resolution on 24th November 2008 as part of its overall plan to achieve higher capital targets set by the UK's Financial Services Authority, that's what it was put in there for, to ensure it would remain independent and not have to be nationalised. Barclays raised $7 billion from investors from Abu Dhabi and Qatar. You see, and this is the way it is. They're not British banks anymore. They're international banks. It's all involved. It's so complicated, multifaceted. So existing Barclays bank holders complained that they were not offered full exemption rights to this round of capital raising, so they didn't get their right to buy back and stuff like this and whatever. And they even threatened to revolt at an extraordinary meeting that was held. Well, Sheikh Mansour and Qatar Holding agreed to open up £500 million of their new holdings of reserve capital instruments for clawback. In other words, to allow them to claw back some of that money. And existing investors now took this up, so they were happy. In 2008, Barclays bought the credit card brand Goldfish for $70 million US, gaining 1.7 million customers and $3.9 billion in receivables, in other words, money owing. Barclays also bought a controlling stake in the Russian retail bank ExpoCheck for $745 million US dollars. Later in the year, Barclays commenced its Pakistan operations with initial funding of $100 million. And it's the rub. You remember we started with Northern Rock and the Lehman Brothers? Because in 2008, Barclays announced its agreement to purchase Lehman Brothers' North American investment banking and trading divisions, along with its New York headquarters building. You gotta wonder, haven't you, if someone, if these things have been happening for centuries, maybe they knew this was going to happen, they planned for it, they worked out how they could make the most money out of it, and that's the way it worked. There you go. That's the beauty of British banking. All right, so that's the end of my show and the end of my shows for a while. Don't forget, you can check all the past shows on www.drnyates.com and my YouTube channel In Congress for a comment or two on those shows. It's been my pleasure being at Beetroot Radio. It's such a fabulous team, such professional, wonderful guys and stuff like this. I've got to go off and write my second book. Well, finish my second book, actually. The drive to do it is killing me right now. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave this for a while. There's nothing wrong. It's all been wonderful. I've really had a great time. This is a fantastic station. You must keep listening, keep supporting them, as I will. All right? So that's that. So it's not really goodbye. It's au revoir, as they say in France, right? Okay. So please have a great rest of the weekend, as I always say. And please, especially as I always say, please take care.